Today is Thursday, July 2nd, and this is the World Socialist Website. The oligarchy in power. Trump pocketed $2.2 billion in 2025. By Barry Gray. On Tuesday, President Donald Trump released his mandatory financial disclosure for 2025. It showed that he more than tripled his personal income during the first year of his term, from $622 million in 2024 to at least $2.2 billion last year. The report provided some indications of the flagrant self-dealing and corruption that enabled the real estate swindler and media huckster turned U.S. president to massively expand his fortune and that of his family. By last September, the collective wealth of the Trump family stood at an estimated $10 billion, having nearly doubled since the November 2024 election. Donald Trump Jr.'s wealth went from $50 million to $300 million, and that of Eric Trump rose tenfold to $400 million. In the same year, labor's share of the national income fell to its lowest level since records began. In the third quarter of 2025, labor's share fell to 53.8%, down from 70% in 1947. These statistics translate in real life into poverty wages and possibly high rents and living costs and longer working hours for tens of millions of workers. An annual income of $2.2 billion is equivalent to the incomes of 37,931 U.S. auto workers, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics estimate of the average auto worker's wage, based on a 40-hour work week. An annual income of $2.2 billion computes to $251,000 per hour. At that rate, someone takes in $70 per second, more than twice what a UAW auto worker earns in an hour. No wonder that at an Oval Office event this week, Trump defended his refusal to sign a bill to increase low-income housing, demanding that Congress first pass his plan to disenfranchise millions of working-class voters and calling the housing bill a, quote, big yawn. In his first term, between 2017 and 2021, Trump broke with the practice of modern presidents who put their financial affairs in blind trusts. He refused to divest from his businesses and place them in a trust he could still access. He used his Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. as a cash cow, encouraging foreign delegations, lobbyists, and Republican officials to spend money that flowed into his personal bank accounts. He granted his daughter, Ivanka, multiple Chinese trademarks while she served as a White House advisor at the same time that U.S.-China trade talks were underway. That, however, pales in comparison to Trump's second term. He refused to sign the ethics pledge he had taken in his first term, rescinded Biden's presidential ethics rules, and fired the head of the Office of Government Ethics early in 2025, leaving it without a permanent director. Trump made the bulk of his 2025 income from his cryptocurrency businesses, which accounted for some $1.4 billion. According to an analysis in the New York Times, his crypto venture, World Liberty Financial, which sells a digital currency called WLFI, took in $799 million last year, compared to $57 million in 2024. 3 days before his second inauguration, Trump helped launch a meme coin, $Trump, which has generated another $636 million. He made $77 million from Mar-a-Lago last year, compared to $50 million in 2024, and $122 million from his Trump National Doral Golf Club, an increase of $11 million. He holds shares in his Trump Media and Technology Group, worth $875 million. At the end of 2025, Trump had investment assets of at least $850 million, compared to $236 million the prior year. Trump's crypto businesses directly benefited from his policy decisions as president. In January 2025, 3 days before his inauguration, an investment firm tied to the government of the United Arab Emirates bought a 49% stake in World Liberty Financial, generating $23 million in profits for the Trump family. Soon after, the Trump administration struck a deal for the U.S. to export computer chips that power artificial intelligence to the UAE. Trump's meme coin business directly benefited from a February 2025 Securities and Exchange Commission statement notifying the industry that such tokens would no longer be subject to the agency's oversight, reversing the position of the agency's chairman during the Biden administration. And Trump signed legislation last July to promote a form of cryptocurrency called stablecoins 4 months after his family-backed firm introduced its own stablecoin. Last October, Trump pardoned Binance founder Changpeng Zhao, the richest man in crypto, who had pleaded guilty in 2023 to violating anti-money laundering laws and served 4 months in prison. Binance has since become a critical business partner to the Trump family's own crypto venture. Crypto, however, is by no means the only area where Trump has used the White House to promote his business ventures and increase his personal wealth. He has licensed the Trump name to properties in countries such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar. These two deals alone generated more than $14 million for Trump in 2025. Last Sunday, the New York Times published an expose about a multi-billion dollar deal between the U.S. and Kazakhstan for the development of tungsten mines in the former Soviet Republic. The project directly involves the sons of Trump and his Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. Billions in loans from the U.S. Commerce Department and the Export-Import Bank are being allocated to finance a venture that stands to generate untold millions in profits for the two families, as well as other billionaire cronies of the president. Then there are the millions being made by members of the financial elite from bets in predictive markets on oil prices, based on advance notice of White House announcements of bombings and/or peace talks with Iran. In a world dominated by oligarchs and their gangster representatives such as Trump, the lives of countless thousands become the stuff of profiteering from manipulated markets. Investigative reports have documented how Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has used his role in negotiations and Middle East policy to secure massive sums from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf monarchies for his private investment vehicles. This is all in addition to the more mundane corruption of the Trump administration, including no-bid contracts to donors with business before the government for projects such as the White House ballroom and the reflecting pool. These are not the crimes of a single individual. The staggeringly wealthy and parasitic financial oligarchy has installed Trump, a fascistic product of the New York real estate and gambling mafia, as the head of state. Nothing reveals the mores of this new aristocracy more than the Epstein scandal, which implicates the heights of official society, and whose cover-up unites Trump, the corporate media, and virtually the entire political establishment. As for the nominal opposition party, the Democrats, they wring their hands and complain, but do nothing to stop the plundering or hold the criminals accountable, because they are controlled by the same class of oligarchs, and defend their system based on the private ownership of the means of production and production for profit. The entire class must be expropriated, and the wealth produced by the working class must be used to meet social needs. In the class struggles in France, 1848 to 1850, written 176 years ago, Karl Marx summed up the degeneration of the ruling class in words that read as though they were written today. Quoting, "Since the finance aristocracy made the laws, was at the head of the administration of the state, had command of all the organized public authorities, dominated public opinion through the actual state of affairs and through the press, the same prostitution, the same shameless cheating, the same mania to get rich was repeated in every sphere, from the court to the café born, to get rich not by production, but by pocketing the already available wealth of others. Clashing every moment with the bourgeois laws themselves, an unbridled assertion of unhealthy and dissolute appetites manifested itself, particularly at the top of bourgeois society. Lusts wherein wealth, derived from gambling, naturally seeks its satisfaction, where pleasure becomes debauched, where money, filth, and blood commingle. The finance aristocracy, in its mode of acquisition as well as in its pleasures, is nothing but the rebirth of the lumpen proletariat on the heights of bourgeois society. End quote. What was true in 1850 is posed even more sharply today. The only social force capable of expropriating this parasitic class and reorganizing economic life to meet social needs is the international working class, mobilized independently of and against both capitalist parties, in the fight to put an end to capitalism and establish socialism. Japanese Yen Hits 40-Year Low by Nick Beams. The Japanese government and its financial arms, the Ministry of Finance and the Central Bank, are becoming increasingly embroiled in a series of economic problems that are leading to a continuous fall in the value of the yen. Earlier this week, the yen weakened to 162 to the U.S. dollar, hitting its lowest level in almost four decades, despite efforts by financial authorities to prop up the currency. In an expression of concern over the weakening, Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Minoru Kahara, told a press conference that the government, quote, stands to take action whenever necessary, unquote. The immediate effect of the falling yen is to increase the price of oil and energy, as Japan is dependent on the Middle East for more than 90% of its supplies. But the hikes will go across the board, as Japan imports much of its food and raw materials. Last year, the price of rice, a staple, soared from 2,000 yen to 5,000 yen for a 5-kilogram bag. While it came back down somewhat this year because of government intervention, it still remains at historically high levels. The latest slide in the yen's value came despite Ministry of Finance intervention in April and May, when it spent a record $72 billion to support it, the money being drawn mainly from Japanese holdings of U.S. Treasury bonds. The intervention and the threats by the government to speculators that it was prepared to do more prompted a rise in the yen's value. But it was short-lived, and its slide continued, reaching its lowest level since December 1986 on Tuesday. More intervention may come. A level of 163 yen to the dollar is being touted as a new line in the sand, and the authorities are said to have, quote, ample ammunition, unquote, with which to intervene. But the measures are not a long-term solution, because the problems go deeper than a temporary currency mismatch. As Bloomberg noted, quote, history is unkind to unilateral FX or foreign exchange intervention, and it's downright brutal when the fundamentals are leaning the other way, which is exactly the trap Japan finds itself in, unquote. A key issue is the divergence between Japanese interest rates and the rest of the world. After years of ultra-low rates, close to zero and at times even negative, the Bank of Japan has lifted its base interest rate to 1% in an attempt to normalize monetary policy. However, this remains well below the rate in the U.S. between 3.5% and 3.75%, with the Fed having ruled out cuts for the foreseeable future because of rising inflation. Lee Hardman, the senior currency analyst at the financial firm MUFG, told the Financial Times that crossing 162 yen was, quote, another reminder of how weak the yen has become. The energy price shock has weighed in on the currency, and the Fed's hawkish policy update is now encouraging higher U.S. rates and a stronger dollar, unquote. Lower rates in Japan have led to international investors borrowing in Japan and then using the money to invest in the U.S. and other markets, leading to an outflow of yen, putting downward pressure on the currency. While the lower value of the yen aids exporters, making their products more competitive in global markets, the authorities cannot allow the yen to slide. This is because such a decision would certainly bring retaliation from the U.S., where the Trump administration, along with others before it, has periodically accused Japan of currency manipulation. A continuing slide will create broader problems. In a comment to the Financial Times, Chris Turner of the financial firm ING noted that authorities recognized that intervention at this point was, quote, an exercise in futility. Turner continued, quote, but they don't want to leave yen losses unchecked in case it triggers a sell Japan mindset, should Japanese government bonds and then equities come under pressure too. Another contributing factor is the very slow rise in the interest rate of the Bank of Japan. It lifted its rate to around 1% in the middle of last month. While this was the highest level since 1995, it is below the inflation rate, now running at 1.5%. and well below other central bank settings. The Bank of Japan is being constrained by political pressure from the Sanae Takaichi government, which wants it to go slow on interest rate hikes. Following her election victory in February, she said she was going to set out a new direction for the Japanese economy. That plan, though short on detail, was unveiled last week. It involves a 370 trillion yen, or $2.3 trillion, investment program based on government-private sector collaboration. It will extend over 14 years, directing investment into 17 key sectors of the economy, with more than $600 billion for AI and semiconductors. Takaichi said Japan's problems did not stem from a lack of innovation or efficiency. She said, quote, what is lacking is domestic investment, unquote, and that the government would support companies that had advanced technologies in sectors such as shipbuilding, solar panels, quantum computers, and the next generation of nuclear reactors. Quote, the Takaichi cabinet will break the cycle of excessive austerity and insufficient investment in the future, unquote. But questions are already being raised about how corporations will be induced to take part. They are supposed to finance more than half of the outlays, and how much the government contribution would add to the national debt, already at around 200% of GDP, the highest for any advanced economy. Investors have already signaled their concerns over financing, with the interest rates on long-term government bonds reaching their highest levels since the 1990s in recent months. The fall in the value of the yen poses an acute dilemma for the government. An increase in the Bank of Japan interest rate would provide a boost to the yen, but such an increase would add to the cost of servicing government debt and have an adverse impact on economic growth. As far as the currency markets are concerned, there is likely to be a continuing slide of the yen, lifting inflation and contributing still further to the real wage cuts for the working class, which will undermine support for the government, unless the Bank of Japan starts to lift rates more than it has so far. The government, however, is pushing to keep them down. According to Bloomberg, the government will unveil its basic policy next month, which sets out the annual blueprint for its economic strategy, with Takaichi, quote, expected to use that document to dissuade the Bank of Japan from further interest rate hikes, unquote. If that turns out to be the case, then it will mean further turbulence for the currency. Colorado primary results show continuing radicalization of U.S. workers and youth, by Patrick Martin. Tuesday's Democratic Party primary contests in Colorado were another demonstration of the shift to the left among workers and young people across the United States. In the congressional district, based on the city of Denver, 15-term incumbent Diana DeGette was defeated for the Democratic nomination by a first-time candidate and member of the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, Milot Kiros. The 29-year-old former lawyer and doctoral student, who came to the U.S. from Ethiopia as an infant, challenged the 68-year-old Degette from the left, particularly on the question of opposition to the U.S.-backed Israeli genocide in Gaza. Before moving back to Colorado, Kiros was fired by a Manhattan law firm in late 2023 for posting material online criticizing Israel and defending those who call for the overthrow of the Zionist state. She also publicly condemned the detention of Hayam El-Gamal and her five children after El-Gamal's husband carried out an attack on a gathering of demonstrators calling for the release of Israeli hostages in Boulder, Colorado, in which one woman was killed. El-Gamal had no knowledge of the planned attack and has since divorced her husband, but she and her five children, some as young as five, were held at a detention center in Dilley, Texas, for more than 6 months. Degette made no such statements in support of the El-Gamal family. Kiros also sought to appeal to anger over the state of the economy and the refusal of the Democratic Party to conduct any serious struggle against the Trump administration, presenting herself as a barista struggling to pay the rent, and criticizing Degette for accepting contributions from corporate PACs, particularly from the healthcare industry. She also vowed not to support House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries for Speaker if the Democrats win control of the House in November. Degette, a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, sought to counter Kiros by running a TV ad that featured Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez praising her support for universal health care. Ocasio-Cortez, a member of the DSA like Kiros, did not endorse anyone in the primary, although Senator Bernie Sanders, Representative Ro Khanna, and Justice Democrats all backed Kiros. Kiros's primary victory in a safe Democratic seat follows last week's primaries in New York State, where three candidates backed by New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani, two of them DSA members, won their races. Brad Lander and Daria Liza Avila Xavier defeated Democratic incumbents, while Claire Valdez won a seat vacated by retirement. The political shift in Colorado impacted statewide races as well. State Attorney General Phil Weiser defeated longtime Senator Michael Bennett in the primary contest for governor, despite being heavily outspent, initially trailing in the polls by more than 30 points, and being depicted in the media as a long-shot candidate. Weiser portrayed Bennett, a three-term senator and son of a longtime State Department official, as a Washington insider, citing his votes to confirm at least 8 Trump cabinet nominees. Weiser, himself a veteran of the Clinton and Obama administrations, presented himself as a more effective opponent of the Trump administration, citing dozens of lawsuits filed by the state government during Trump's 2 terms, most of them successful. In the other major statewide contest, Senator John Hickenlooper barely staved off a challenge from State Senator Julie Gonzalez, also a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, whose state Senate district is in Denver. Hickenlooper won by 53.4% to 46.6%, a very narrow margin for a 2-term incumbent with a massive 9-to-1 financial advantage. Gonzalez received 394,739 votes statewide and defeated Hickenlooper in Denver itself. In the closely contested 8th Congressional District, which has swung back and forth between the Democratic and Republican parties since it was created after the 2020 census, State Representative Manny Rutinel, an immigrant from the Dominican Republic, won the Democratic primary to face Republican incumbent Gabe Evans, defeating a more right-wing opponent. Like Kiros, Rutinel had the backing of Bernie Sanders and Justice Democrats. The victory of Kiros in Denver was the clearest expression of the growing radicalization from below, which the Democratic Party is seeking desperately to restrain. Doug Friednash, former chief of staff to Hickenlooper when he was Colorado's governor, told Politico, quote, "Voters are angry. They are all anti-establishment, and don't feel like our leaders have fought hard enough and don't have a coherent voice. Kyros is the clincher. Twitch streamer Hassan Piker campaigned online for Kyros in the weeks leading up to the primary and traveled to Denver to campaign with her in person on primary day. He told Politico, quote, "A 30-year incumbent was defeated tonight. It's clear that there is a real hunger for change. Democrats all over the country are demanding it." He added, quote, "That change is a working-class-centered movement. It's socialism. We are not done yet." For all of Piker's demagogy, which the WSWS has analyzed in detail, the surge to the left expressed in the victory of DSA candidates cannot transform the Democratic Party into a socialist or working class party. This is one of the twin parties of the capitalist ruling class in America, indissolubly linked to Wall Street and the military intelligence apparatus. This is shown even in the results of the Colorado primary, as it was in New York State last week, side by side with DSA members who are the initial beneficiaries of the shift to the left among workers and youth. The Democratic Party is putting forward candidates drawn directly from the national security apparatus of American imperialism. In New York's 17th Congressional District in the Hudson Valley, the Democrats are running Kate Conley, a 16-year active-duty Army officer who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, against Republican incumbent Mike Lawler. In 4 of the 8 congressional districts in Colorado, the Democratic Party is running such candidates, including four-term incumbent Jason Crow, a former Army Ranger in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars, in the 6th Congressional District in the Denver suburbs. Retired Rear Admiral Eileen Lawbucker, a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy with a 34-year career in naval intelligence, including tours in Afghanistan and India, is running against Republican incumbent Lauren Boebert in the 4th Congressional District, covering the rural eastern half of the state. Jessica Killen, a former paratrooper and military police captain in the Balkans, who then held military-related jobs in Washington, ending as chief of staff to Doug Emhoff, husband of then-Vice President Kamala Harris, is challenging Republican incumbent Jeff Crank in the 5th Congressional District, centered on Colorado Springs. In addition, a West Point graduate and Army engineer in the 1990-91 Persian Gulf War, now a property developer, Dwayne Romero, is the Democratic candidate in the 3rd Congressional District in West and Southwest Colorado against incumbent Republican Jeff Hurd. Any of these candidates could win in November and join the growing ranks of what we have called the CIA Democrats in Washington. This has been Paul Fuller for the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist Website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.